You're listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the curtain at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features in-depth interviews with the singers, conductors, and creative minds behind the productions in the 2007-2008 season. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.
Mezzo-soprano Joyce DiDonato and baritone Nathan Gunn are backstage at Lyric.
It's a wonderful thing working with Joyce and with John because they're actually engaged when you're on stage. I run into a lot of performers, especially when it comes to bel canto music, where they're thinking notes, and they're thinking, get the notes and make sure you do it right because that person did it once and someone's going to think, well, that wasn't like so-and-so, you know, and they have this going into their head, but that's really not what it's about. Rossini took care of all that for us. He wrote the notes. We try to get that. It's never going to be perfect. I mean, sometimes it is in rehearsal, but if you actually let yourself go in a performance, it's not going to be what you would expect, which is good, actually.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Backstage at Lyric, a podcast that takes you behind the scenes of one of the world's great opera companies. I'm Roger Pines of Lyric Opera of Chicago. For this episode, we're playing an audio transcript of the Lyric Opera Discovery Series session for The Barber of Seville. For those of you who may not be aware of the Discovery Series, it's panel discussions featuring singers, conductors, directors, and opera experts. We do one session per opera, and they usually take place a few days prior to the opening of the production. The Discovery Series is open to the public, and it's a great way to get up close and personal with our artists. You can check out our website at www.lyricopera.org for dates, tickets, and complete Discovery Series information. We're including all of the Discovery Series sessions as part of the Backstage at Lyric podcast. And now, on to the Discovery Series panel featuring Joyce DiDonato and Nathan Gunn. I'm your host for this session, and I hope you enjoy it.
I'm Roger Pines, dramaturg at Lyric Opera of Chicago, and I'm delighted to welcome all of you on this very snowy night to our Discovery Series session on Il Barbiere di Siviglia, The Barber of Seville. Thank you so much for being here. Let me say a brief word about our two wonderful guests, whose careers are definitely among the most brilliant in opera. Mezzo-soprano Joyce DiDonato is debuting at Lyric this season as Rosina. She's triumphed in that role in 9 major houses, including new productions at the Met, the Opéra National de Paris, and Covent Garden. She appeared in the Met's Barber movie simulcast last season, and her Paris performance is currently on DVD. She's having a wonderful 2007-08 season, beginning with role debuts as Strauss's Octavian in San Francisco, and Handel's Ariadante in Geneva, followed by another Rossini role she has made her own, that is Cenerentola, which she sang in Houston. She has terrific engagements coming up, including Cappelletti e Montecchi in Paris, and her first Donna Elvira in Don Giovanni at Covent Garden. Nathan Gunn, our Figaro, attracted enormous international attention for his Lyric debut as Britain's Billy Budd, which I assume all of you heard. He has returned to us for Sweeney Todd in last season's Così fan tutte. His Munich concert performance of The Barber of Seville with the Bavarian Radio Orchestra was released on CD. It's an opera he's also sung in San Francisco, Vancouver, and St. Louis. He spent last summer at the Aix-en-Provence Festival singing The Marriage of Figaro, and in December, he returned to the role of Billy Budd with the London Symphony Orchestra. He'll soon be heard in recital at Carnegie Hall's Zankel Hall, and he'll return to Glyndebourne this summer for the world premiere of Peter Utbus's Love and Other Demons. These two singers share an extraordinary distinction. They are the only winners to date of the Metropolitan Opera's Beverly Sills Award. The late, great Miss Sills chose them for the award herself, Nathan in 2006 and Joyce in 2007. Please join me in welcoming to the Discovery Series Joyce DiDonato and Nathan Gunn. This opera premiered nearly 2 centuries ago, and yet, unlike so much other Rossini repertoire, it's never lost its popularity. In fact, I think it's easy to make a case for it as the most popular comedy in the operatic repertoire. So let's start by speaking in a general way to our audience about what it offers them that has sustained its popularity for so many years.
Well, great music to begin with. I mean, really, it starts with the music. The music is absolutely beautiful. And Rossini has this ability to write comedic music, comedic opera. I mean, it's a rare thing, actually. Think of how many new operas that come out these days that are actually funny. But, I mean, funny, like really funny. Yeah, funny, funny, ha-ha. Yeah, and I think that's the beginning of it. Also, there are some wonderful, some of the characters are actually caricatures of people. Because if you think about it, Rosina and the Count and Figaro are not really very funny. They don't do too many things that are funny. They create funny situations, but the humorous characters are, you know, Berta and Basilio, always, you know, some conniving, and Bartolo. So I think we can obviously, we can all identify a little bit with what's going on and feeling, especially the situation being overwhelmed. You know, Bartolo seems like he's being attacked from all sides to create chaos, which he is. And it's like that old saying, even though you're paranoid, you think you're paranoid, it doesn't mean that everybody's not out to get you or whatever. Yeah. It's kind of like that. So it sets up a great, you know, situation comedy for that.
The other thing that I think plays into it, it's very much like Nozze di Figaro, and that we forget this only takes place in one day. And we both actually did a production in San Francisco, not in the same cast, but we had a revolving house that you could see all things, and you really got the sensation that this was the day in the life of a household that just goes a little off.
Yeah.
And the poor, and it is Bartolo that everything revolves around, and he has one thing thrown at him, one thing after the other. Yeah. And I think it's the building up of these situations that create the comedy. The fact that it's based on such a brilliant play doesn't hurt matters. And Rossini came and threw this music, the percussion and the patter that he gets going. It really makes it come alive.
I mean, there is a moment in the first act finale that I just sort of wait for, because musically it's so brilliant. Is there like a page of music in this score that you just can't wait to hear, whether you're singing it or not, that you just find so entrancing that no matter how many times you hear it, it just hits you every time?
I love all of it, and this will sound kind of strange. I don't think this is going to be a standard answer. But one of the moments I like the most, and it might just be because I know this opera so well, I love the recit near the end when you finally agree to marry him because you're so full of despair, mm-hmm. because you feel like you've been betrayed. It's the one moment where all this funny stuff that's been going on, all these things we've been laughing, you know, and enjoying the silly situations, then all of a sudden you see a very vulnerable side to Rosina, which to me, maybe because I know this opera so well and also Nozze so well, you see a glimpse of the Countess. And I find that really beautiful.
It's as if she says, "Quanto, quanto crudella sorte mia."
Yeah.
Dove sono? Yeah. She could really go into that
yeah.
aria.
Well,
that's point.
That extends from it, right?
Yeah. And that's the point for me when her real humanity comes out. Mm-hmm. That you really see that she's not just a character who sings this bubbly music, but she really is going to be the Countess in 3 years.
Yeah, and she's not a girl; she's a woman, mm-hmm. and this is her life.
Yeah,
and you know it's kind of funny to think that he has three locks and he always locks her in whenever he leaves and all of this and I don't know one thing I don't understand is how Figaro ends up being able to roam freely in this house.
You know what I mean? All the time.
You know, there all the time, but he seems to think he's not very, you know, he's harmless.
Yeah. For me, there's this is one of the reasons I think it's such a brilliant opera, because yes, it's comedic and it has the very famous arias that everybody's, you know, waiting to hear, and that's always exciting. But it's also these moments that surprise you, like the canzonetta, yeah. the little Spanish song that the tenor sings, which is this heart-stopping, romantic, beautiful thing, and it could be Donizetti. It's just as if time stands still, and this is from Rossini, who's not supposed to create these beautiful melodies, mm-hmm. and yet there it is. In the Act One finale, also when everybody's frozen, and we get and there's all this space around the music, and somehow he can sustain this tension through adding 1, 2, 3, 4 characters, and the tension builds and builds and builds, and it's just
Brilliant. Now, each of you start this opera off with one of Rossini's most familiar arias, and I think in Figaro's case, it's probably one of the most recognizable arias for any vocal category that's ever been written.
La 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 something.
So
I ran out of text.
I want to talk about them a bit. I mean, Nathan, what do we learn about him in the course of this piece? I mean, we learn what he does, I mean, his tasks in life, but as far as his character, what do we learn from the Largo Affectuoso?
Well, I think you learn almost everything you need to know about him at that point, because he is... and I think this is also true for the Beaumarchais and for the play. He is one of us. He's an everyday man. He wasn't born with a silver spoon in his mouth. He wasn't born with any help. As a matter of fact, you find out he was actually an orphan, right?
I mean,
eventually. And so he has made his own way. He wakes up and he's happy. He's ready to go to work. And he finds humor in the fact that what he really does is create situations where he can bring people together. That's really what his job is. And he says this at the, you know, right after the aria. He says, you know, it's such a funny job that I have because, during the day I am a barber and I take care of these things and people meet and come to me and I move letter to letter. You know, I get a little money for passing along a message to somebody else. And then at night I've got the guitar and I'm helping the romance that way, moving it on. But that's his job. He's clever, he's good-willed, and he is a survivor, I suppose. And, you know, and this, I'll amend this statement. I think you do learn something about him as well once you see how he behaves around the count. Because what's interesting also is that even though he is, you know, he's the title character, he's sort of the protagonist, but you are always reminded throughout the opera, and this is also kind of funny, but... There's always that's a great thing about Rossini. There's always a little bit of a smile underneath everything, you know, that the Count is the one in charge. It's his world. He runs that world, and Figaro has to work within it. If the Count says jump, he jumps, and he does. He might try to get as much out of him as he can, but he still is definitely under the thumb, mm-hmm. At the whim of whatever this particular person of status so chooses. And that's once again kind of a dark side to all of this, but it's the lesson if it weren't in this, then it wouldn't be a very interesting story. The Count has to be special. The only way he gets out of all these goofy situations is the fact that he has a particular medal that says, I own you, and everybody else is, whoa! And it moves the comedy along.
Mm-hmm. Joyce, what do we learn about
a lot. There's a lot to learn about her. the first thing that's so important and that I think sometimes gets lost in performances is she's totally and completely enamored with this voice that she's heard. And not only is it that she's enamored with it, but it's also the ticket for her. It's a glimpse of, this might be my ticket out of here. And what I'd like to experiment with through the run of the opera is, does she really fall in love with this tenor, or is it just a way out? In the second act, she has a lesson scene, and she says, you have to get me out of here. You have to save me. She's not saying, I love you, I love you, I love you. And there's no love duet for these two. In essence, the love duet actually happens between Figaro and Rosina. That's the big special duet that happens. So I find it really interesting... and I think through the course, especially the way we're staging it here, that she really starts to fall in love with the Count during the Act One finale and how much he fights for her to stay in the house. And then during the lesson scene, they have these couple little moments. And I think it's important for me to capitalize on those moments of intimacy between the two of them. The next segment of the aria is, of course, the one that gets the main punch from Rossini. And it's, again, not... professing love, but she's saying, you know, I do everything I'm supposed to and it's all good, but if anybody ever crosses me, they'll pay. And sure enough, that's what comes back in the recit at the end with Bartolo. She's saying, okay, I'll show him. You want to get married? Let's get married. So it's very much about the character of Rosina. The other thing, she talks a really, really big talk in this aria. I'll lay 100 traps and I'll do all this. But I don't think she's ever really had to put her money where her mouth is in this way before, except in this one day that again unravels. All of a sudden, all these situations are coming and she's trying to handle it with the help of Figaro and with the improvisation of the Count. And what's interesting is I think it takes her by surprise. And she says, oh, that worked. I really am a viper. But I don't know how convinced she is right at the beginning. I think it's a discovery process throughout the day for her.
Also have vocally demanding material in these two pieces. It's the first thing you sing in the opera. So what do these pieces demand of you on the vocal side, and what sort of preparation do you have to do so that you can go on and in your entrance aria, you know, hit your marks, as it were?
Warm up. I don't know. Don't drink too much the night before. No bar hopping on the day before the performance. No.
Turn out the cigarette.
Yeah, put out the cigarette. Yeah, no smoking. It's what we do. I mean, really, it's, you know, I don't know about you, Joyce, but I don't really do anything different depending, you know, for any role. I'm always, you know, I make sure you're completely warmed up. Because it's not just, you know, it's not just tricks that you have to do when you sing. You have to also, when you're warming up, you're getting your voice mobile. It's like warming up for an athletic event. Even if you were to mark, I sometimes, you know, warm up like I would for a performance before a rehearsal, just because I want to be able to sing the recits in a way that are healthy and where I can do everything I want. So, I do what I do. I'm sure I'm there in enough time to sort of have my head on straight, because believe it or not, the trick for me, the harder stuff in this aria is not necessarily the vocal demands. I've been working on that a whole long time. I mean, it's been what my work is about, is learning how to sing and turning, you know, these sustained words into something that communicates to everybody. It's remembering what to do. I have so much stuff to do during the beginning of that aria. You know, how do I, hoping that maybe my shirt, when I finally get it on, is buttoned correctly, so it's not like, you know, this way, and remembering that. And so, you know, I'm believe it or not, I'm kind of focused on that as well, and make sure I have a hold of the pole before I slide down. That's a good thing. You know, don't fall off when I'm trying to put the trousers on. So, I do some calisthenics, stretch out my legs. And, you know.
Does it enter into your mind at all that it's such a famous aria before you sing it?
Yeah, but I try not to think so much about that. The great thing about our art form is that it's there and then it's gone. Live performance, you have it and then it goes away. And we never really remember exactly what it was like. And we were talking about this after rehearsal today. It's a wonderful thing working with Joyce and with John, because they're actually engaged when you're on stage. I run into a lot of performers, especially when it comes to bel canto music, where they're thinking notes, and they're thinking, get the notes and make sure you do it right, because that person did it once and someone's going to think, well, that wasn't like so-and-so, you know, and they have this going into their head. But that's really not what it's about. Rossini took care of all that for us. He wrote the notes. We try to get that. It's never going to be perfect. I mean, sometimes it is in rehearsal, but if you actually let yourself go in a performance, it's not going to be what you would expect, which is good, actually. So I think, from my point of view, is I offer what I have to offer. Some people accept it, some people don't, and that's okay. And then, you know, the next person will come and have what they have to offer, and the fact that they're different is actually a wonderful thing.
I think that's experience a lot, or you're an extraordinary guy from the beginning, but... I know when I first started.
I want you to expand on that.
Yada yada la 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 la. Anyway, but I know at the beginning when I first started doing this role, I think the Barber's Aria and Una Voce are the arias when you're 18 and you're in college and you start singing it and you start acting like you know how to sing it, and you get into a mess of problems you shout and you scream and you cross your fingers and hope that it all comes out. But then you sort of, over a decade or so, you start to work out the kinks. And hopefully at this point now, we're not thinking technically at that point. I still warm up and I still go over phrases. Is that okay? But by this point, I just want to play with it. But at the beginning, when I was doing my first Rosinas, I got so scared, because usually Rosina's preset on the stage. So she's waiting while the set changes and she's sitting there for 5 minutes going... And then you know that everybody in the audience has Berganza and Horn and Frederica von Stade and, you know, all these voices that they've heard and that they love because they're the supreme fabulous interpretations. And so you start mentally going, I can't do it that way. And Berganza had great technique, and Bartoli goes really fast. And then you go, ooh, novo. And that's what comes out the first phrases. So what I think is one aspect, we've had a bunch of illnesses during this rehearsal, and we've had a little cast change you might have heard about for the tenor. And so the covers have been working here, and they're great, and they're all part of the Lyric Center here and so talented. But we were talking about this one day that there's something about experience that comes into it, because now I come out, I'm not trying to compete with the voices of the past. I'm trying to make it real in the moment and make it fresh, which means really thinking about the text.
Yeah, exactly.
And really, the cadenzas happen not because I've studied them for 3 years in my practice room, but because Rosina gets a little excited. And out comes these notes, and she doesn't even know what's going to come out next, hopefully. But I think that's experience, and we're not trying to sound good. We're trying to tell a story up
that's
there.
I agree with you. It's the difference between sounding like a really good graduate student and somebody who's actually a professional. You have to eventually, the schooling is very necessary. You have to go through many years of schooling and observing great artists and all of that in order to do this. But there comes a time where you have to realize this isn't a competition. Yeah. People have paid to come and enjoy themselves, and your job is to help them with that.
But I had to exercise some of those ghosts because I was competing, but with people that had sung it 30 years before. I have a friend who's a painter, and we were talking about the differences in our art form, and he just said, I don't know how you do it. You're competing against all these things that have come before you, meaning the voices of the past. And I think, well, if you let yourself think that way, but on the other hand, like you said, what happens in the now and in the minute, there is no competition. It's just there. And it's as alive as we make it with the moment.
Thank you. In any Barber performance, I think it's Rosina and Almaviva, the mezzo and the tenor, who have the lion's share of the florid singing, the ornamentation. And Joyce, I've heard some singers say, I was born with the ability to move my voice. And others say that they were taught to do it. How did it work for you? Is it something you've always been able to do?
My voice naturally has agility, I will say that. Like, one of the things that I work on technically, I never really work on speed, because I know it will be there. I'm lucky, hopefully that will stay with me. The thing that I really have to work on is accuracy. And I think that's where the clarity and cleanliness in this music comes from. I also sing a lot of Handel, and that's hard. That's really hard. And I come back to Rossini and I think, oh, yeah, I know exactly where it's going, whereas Handel does this. And the thing that I really have to drill is making sure that I'm in the center of the pitch, that it's a real vowel, and it's so boring, all the singery stuff.
Yeah, but what's wonderful about Joyce, too, and this is unusual, I'll compliment you here in front of all these people, is that not only does she have agility and be able to flexibility with her voice, she can move it around and all of that, because there are a number of mezzos out there who can do that in sopranos, but she can also sustain, and often the two don't go together. So she ends up being able to do something that other people can't.
Anything else you'd like to say about
that? No, that's it. That's it. Maybe another one about 10 years.
I think it's wonderful to hear an aria like Una Voce Poco Fa and hear it done with ornamentation that other people don't do, which is what one experiences when you sing it. So I take it that a lot of those ornaments are composed by you.
Right.
Over the years, and a lot of them have come out of stagings. There's one that I've kept, if it makes sense, in the show that I'm doing, but it was in Houston, and she was a really girly Rosina, which was fun to play, because it's a little bit opposite of me, but she had a perfume bottle, and they wanted a squirt on one note, so I had da ba da ya ba ba, and I've just sort of kept it. It's kind of fun, but they have to be organic for me, yeah.
Do do people ever come up to you and say, oh, I think on Mi Fo Guidar you should do this ornament? And so do the people ever actually hand you ornamentation and say, oh, try that?
No, a couple people have tried to steal it. They do. I had a coach in New York, and she came up and she goes, can you tell me what you do there? And she had her score in hand. I went,
That's the highest compliment theft.
It really is, in a way, isn't it? Yeah.
There are a few conductors that have strong opinions about it, but I try and...
Ignore them.
No. I try to say, yes, Meister, yes. And, oh, I forgot.
Oh,
I'm
just
sorry.
Can't get it right.
Oh, what did I
get? You run into a female conductor. That doesn't work with female conductors. Like, women get away with a lot with male conductors.
We're performing Barbara Seville in the new critical edition now. How does that affect your role specifically, both of you?
I had to. How long did we work? Maybe 15 minutes when we went through with the piano the first time, Figaro's first aria, and he's like, la, ran, la, la, ran, la, 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 la. Okay, instead of la, 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 or la, 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 ran, la, 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 ran, la. Okay, so we spent a lot of time working on that. You'll all notice that at the beginning, I'm sure. Besides that, one or two very subtle word changes.
I heard.
I remember. I was listening on the speaker on the fourth floor the other day, and it was the very opening with Fiorello singing his introduction.
Nonce,
and all of a sudden, nonce, and I thought,
oh,
I've never heard that before.
Yeah.
Well,
there's a big one in the opening line of Rosina's aria.
Oh yeah.
If she can remember to do it, she's been singing this aria one way for a long time. And, okay, since you guys have come out on a very cold, snowy evening in Chicago, you'll get the scoop. I'll tell you. She goes, una voce poco fa, qua nel cor.
Wow.
Qua, non qui, qua.
Qua and qui, but they can mean the same thing. I don't know where it came from, but we have to do it. So I know on opening night there's going to be a bunch of, eh?
She forgot it. She forgot the words.
The other day in the rehearsal, I went, una voce poco fa, qui on el cor. It's muscle memory and brain memory, so very, it's a tricky thing.
Now, I'm sure you've gotten the impression from what Nathan was talking about a moment ago that this is a physically very active production. Now, you had mentioned a pole.
Yeah, there's a pole.
And
I get to work on my, thank God I had so many years of pole dancing to like, I'm prepared for this now.
How does the pole figure into the Largo al Factotum?
I start off in a lot. Well, he actually, you know, normally you would say that's another. That's a change because of the production. Or su presto alla bottega presto fuori or whatever I say, which means now it's time to go. Instead of to my shop, I'm time to go out because I start in the shop. So the very beginning of the aria, he's asleep in his loft in the shop, and the way he gets down after. Getting most of his clothes on is a pole that he slides down, and I'm supposed to land in my shoes, but that never works. It's supposed to I go down the pole and whoosh, but it doesn't happen. but that's the only time I have to deal with a pole. Bartolo, though, has to deal with a pole too backstage, doesn't he? He has to slide down. You don't get to see it. You just kind of hear a like that.
And then there's some shaving that you have to do during the aria also.
Oh, yeah. I shave myself. I shave, and I have to... I have to get completely dressed from nothing with, well, not nothing, but I have, you know, and deal with children coming in and out and handing over of letters and taking care of a wig and cutting that and dealing with that. And is that it? I can't think about it right now. I'm gonna start forgetting about it. But basically, yeah, it's everything you would do to prepare to go out.
I mean, we all remember from the end of Billy Budd that you are a very physically courageous performer on the stage. So I wanted to ask both of you if anybody's ever asked you to execute a bit of stage business that where you just said, uh-uh.
I'm pretty much game for anything, I have to say. If the director can convince me that it has substance and that there's a purpose to it. There have been a few things that have been really challenging, and this is a little manipulative, but I've sort of learned, again, experience is a great thing, that if you make it look really bad, but you make it look like you're trying, the director will himself say, oh, that doesn't work. And you say, are you sure we could try it again? But it... terrible. See, you guys are getting the inside inside scoop. But it's, for the most part, I really have been lucky to work with generally really good directors, and we can, hopefully there's a dialogue that's happening, and hopefully it's a director that likes singers and wants to put them in their best position. John Copley here
is
a master at it. Yep. Just and because he loves singers. Yeah. There are, unfortunately now, I've come across, luckily, just less than a handful, that you can tell they sort of have a contempt for singers, which is, it's really disheartening, because I don't know why they're just not doing a different, you know, milieu. Why don't they just do theater or film or something? But it's like, oh, well, why can't you do execute this? You think, because I have a first job to do, actually, which is sing.
By the way, before I forget, John Copley stopped me on the way out, and he said to say hello, and that he was sorry he couldn't be here tonight. He's working on, they grabbed him, you know, what, 12th hour for Merry Widow, and he had meetings and to prepare. Anyway, he's the director we're talking about, who is wonderful. So I just thought I would let you all know that.
Now, you're performing in a staging that he created way back in the 89-90 season, where, Nathan, your role was played by Sir Thomas Allen, and Joyce, yours by Frederica von Stade. Are there bits of staging that were created for the two of them that Mr. Copley is working with you on and is finding different ways to sort of accomplish the same thing?
Yeah, I can think of a couple bits that Tom came up with that I'm doing, but I'm not going to tell you what they are. I'll let you think I came up with it. I steal stuff from Sir Thomas Allen all the time. Last year, Cozy, all I did was memorize his Alfonso for the day that I get to do it, because he's so brilliant on stage. And I'll claim it as mine, too. So I'm not. So no, actually, it's all mine. did I say that? Yes, I did. But John is the type of director where, like he said a couple of days ago, he said, you know, he's there, he watches, he lets you come up with whatever you need. And then what he did with me was come in and say, you know, this scene and this scene, I think if you were to think of it like that, that might be exactly, you know, he gave me a specific idea. Otherwise, but, you know, that's just how he works with me. I don't know if he works with everybody that way. There's some directors that are like that. They let you kind of create on your own within the framework that they've established. And then, you know, add little bits and pieces that they think are helpful, or if it doesn't work, they take it away. He wants it all to make sense, which is really great.
But I will say that it can be really perilous to step into a production that was done 25, 28 years ago.
Well, sometimes they don't show. I mean, if the director's dead, for example, then you don't know what...
And they're reading the staging from a book.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Any why question can't be answered.
Right.
And somebody's making it up. But it is a luxury to have John here. It really, really is. He's a legend and an icon, and he's part of a link to 50 years ago with Collis and these great people. And you think about the original cast for this. Boy, were you guys lucky.
Yeah, no kidding.
To have a Barber cast like this. For us coming in 28, 29 years later, it makes perfect sense, because it was done so well the first time. It was, everything makes sense to the characters, everything fits with the music. So for us to come into it, it's like putting on an old pair of slippers. Oh, right, that makes perfect sense. Yeah. And
don't you ever sit and think about, like I was thinking about this when our run through today and yesterday. It's such an honor, at least for me, who I've always been a big fan of Sir Thomas Allen, and to work with him is great. But to know, you know, that he created the part, you know what I mean? You know, he was up in the exact same situation doing the same sort of thing, thinking, all right, what do? I get up and I have to throw the mattress over the thing first. Right, I got that, and then I do this. And, you know, he had all that stuff that goes through our head before you begin, and just then you sit down and then you let it all go, and then you do what you do. But it's a wonderful thing at the Met, what they often do. I don't think they have that here so much, is you'll look into a costume of an old production that you're doing, and they have all the names of everybody who had sung that role. It's really cool,
isn't
it?
That's the coolest thing.
Yeah, it's really wonderful.
I my best costume story was, I was doing a Cenerentola, and they were using the costumes from Ponell, and I get in. Berganza is in the bodice.
Yeah.
Frederica von Stade is the skirt. They had to let it out. Maybe they even had to add a panel. I don't know. Just like this big. And I had a hairpiece that was Renee Fleming.
No kidding.
And it's impossible not to walk out on stage, shake a little bit, but feel like a million bucks, yeah, you know? Yeah. That's a goosebump moment.
I've heard both of you talk wonderfully about the Rosina Figaro relationship.
Yeah.
I mean, she spends as much, if not more, time with him on the stage than she does with Almaviva. So can we talk a bit about her view of him and his view of her and what sort of contact they would have with each other on a daily basis?
Well, Figaro's constantly fighting off Rosina because she's just so forward. And so he's really just saying, look, you know, it's not going to happen. I know you've asked a number of times, but I think this tenor would be more suited towards you. And that's pretty much it.
Depends on who's playing Figaro.
Yeah. it is a cool relationship, though.
I mean, they spend so much time together. And I think at least the way it's that Rossini pairs them, certainly in the duet, is they're sparring partners.
Yeah.
And they get, I think, so much fun because they play the context of, you know, Rosina's a certain class and Figaro really is the hired help. So they play into that. But on the other hand, for Rosina, Figaro is the one voice from the outside. Tell me the news. Who was on the street? What happened? Oh, I saw you talking to a man. And she's I meant to say this earlier in the first question. I think the other reason this opera and play works so well is it's that age-old story of the clash of generations. So you have the young generation rising up against the older one, and that's a universal thing. And Rosina's stuck all alone. Berta's old. Basilio comes in all the time, and he's a creep, and then Bartolo. So Figaro really is the ray of sunshine that comes in, and I think she depends on him a lot,
yeah.
Although she can't really show it too much. But I think they enjoy playing the game of one-upping each other.
Yeah, and there's an understanding. There's a, you know, and what's fun about the relationship and the way Rossini said it is that you can go all sorts of different directions with it. You know, you could change it every night. Really, it's very subtle. It could be a little confrontational. He could be a little, you know, or she could. You could do whatever. You could you could have them be much more flirtatious. You could have them. There's all sorts of inside information going on. Get a little bit more irritated. It depends because I'm sure what you see on the stage and in that particular opera, that scene has happened. Except for maybe the count. That scene has happened many times. She said, okay, so what's going on? And did I hear something about so-and-so? And so he's always relaying information. He's trying to get something now and tries to get her to do something. And he thinks he always thinks he's kind of on top of it. And then she always gets in there. And some days he's more irritated by that. Other days he's proud of her. You know what I mean? Sometimes he just is, you know.
It really, I think it is the most established relationship.
Definitely,
I mean, the duet with the Count also establishes, but it's a distant kind of relationship. But it's, to me, the most fascinating one.
They genuinely like each other. They're friends. I mean, you know, they're the only ones who are really friends on stage, I think.
Both of you have had such significant experience with the operas of Mozart. Mm-hmm.
Should I compare it to? Those operas are very different. Like Così is an ensemble opera. It really is. And if everybody isn't strong, it can be very weak. Figaro is one of those where Nozze is. If depending on how strong each character is, it changes the whole story. Mm-hmm. You know, if the Count and the Countess are kind of weak in their delivery of it, then it seems kind of like a light piece. If the Susanna and the Figaro are weak, then all of a sudden it seems like a very dark and heavy piece. So this certainly relies on ensemble, definitely. I mean, otherwise it doesn't really offer a story, I suppose. Is that what we're kind of getting at? If the ensemble isn't strong, the story isn't told. If it's all individuals doing their part, then
it's one of these
more
operas,
like a concert,
that actually can anger me at times because it still works.
Yeah.
If everybody's not 100% committed to the same, telling the same story, it still works because you have the big numbers and everybody looks forward to it. But it can be so great when it is a real ensemble piece. And I think, sadly, unfortunately, a lot of times it falls short of that, and that's why it frustrates me. But if everybody really is on the same page and rooting for it, we all get our big moment, we all get the big aria, but that happens in the first half hour. So now that's out of the way. Let's get about to telling the story. And when it sizzles, it's amazing.
And in truth, the aria is not the point of the opera. The aria is in order to move the story along. So we have to remember that. If you forget that and you think the aria is all it's about, then all of a sudden it's about the aria, and then the story stops. But if it's done in such a way where the blocking makes sense and where everybody's engaged and they're saying, okay, this is his moment where, or her moment where she's just thinking out loud, and it moves on into what the whole point is, which is this wonderful coming together of these two individuals and how that happens, the funny circumstances that surround it.
But there you were at Joyce's Cherubino observing the character who had once been Rosina, and there you are, Nathan, playing the Count. So I'm interested in sort of if there's any sort of crossover from one to the other in terms of your own experience on the stage in Barber and having had this Figaro experience.
It's kind of gone, for me, it goes the other direction. Like I was this summer when I was performing the Count in the Mozart opera, Marriage of Figaro. There are a couple moments where the man who is playing Figaro kind of lapsed into that what you're talking about, where it's sort of, I'm playing Figaro, and I'm going to be this, and I'm going to give the aria, and this is, you know, he's a clever man, and he's manipulating everybody. And what irritated me about it was that he forgot his place. You know what I mean? Mm. It wasn't that he wasn't a colleague that was of this, you know, same stature and everything that I am. It was that he forgot that within the opera itself, he was subservient to the Count, and he would do things that were not appropriate. And I couldn't really get him to understand why. You know, it was an awkward situation. And so I thought to myself, coming back at it as Figaro in this particular opera, to always remember that, you know, I used to think it was, you know, at the beginning when he sees the Count and he's like, oh, eccellenza, you know. Oh, you know, I was, for, as an American, we think, what is that about? But in fact, he means it. If the Count says you look, you know, you're such a silly guy, or you're such a, don't be such a jerk. You say thank you, sir. You know, really, that's the way it was. You would never do anything to upset him or to question his authority. And so, I always keep that in mind, because even though I might be working for him or with him in this comedy, I always have to remember that there are certain things you don't do. You know, you don't sit before him. His desires come first, and he expects it too, which makes you behave differently around my friend John Osborne, who is, you know, playing Count Almaviva, so that when I'm with him and I'm Figaro, I don't behave the same way. And Nathan isn't Nathan who is around him, it's Figaro around him, and you have to give that space, and that makes his character, I think, much more effective too. So that's something I do take from the Mozart, I suppose.
I know for me that the transformation at the very end of the opera happens very quickly. But when the Count asks her, Rosina, to marry him and become his wife, she immediately is accepting to become the Countess. 2 seconds ago, she thought she would be marrying a poor student, and she was okay with that, or I guess 5 minutes ago. But all of a sudden, not only is this man that she has fallen in love with during the day, asked her to marry him, but now she's going to assume a certain stature. And so I try to remember, it's a little more difficult in this one production, but I try to remember that immediately her deportment has to change a little bit. The thing I love about Nozze is you think about it, who's the character who actually comes up with the idea to play the trick on the Count? It's Rosina. She says, I know, Susanna, why don't we write a letter? And why don't you dress up like me? And that's one of these cento trappole, one of these, you know, 100 tricks that she's still the same character, and she's thinking ahead of everybody else. And I love that.
How do you keep the comedic element present, but at the same time totally sort of play for real and make these people absolutely believable?
Well, we have to rely a bit on the director to guide us. But I know for me, so many of the productions that I've done of Barber, you go and they're sort of like, oh, we're tired of all the shtick, so let's make it real. And you think, but it's supposed to be funny. And they've sort of taken everything out. And I'm, in a way, I'm glad I've had that experience because they go for 2 big laughs rather than 100 laughs. And so for me, this is a production that seems to be heavy on the shtick, and I'm loving it. This is like the Barber I've been waiting to do. But because of the character work I've done before, I don't feel the impulse to just go for the laugh. I think the key is playing the situation. And there's nothing really that happens in this case that is out of the character, or out of the situation. If we don't play for... Well, except
maybe one thing.
Yeah.
Which is very funny.
Poor Basilio.
I know. That's very funny.
But I just think, you know, we have to rely on the director to say that's too much or that's not enough. But it's really just staying in the moment, making it a real situation.
Yeah.
As you know, opera companies' education programs are constantly thinking of new ways to connect the standard repertoire to popular culture in whatever way they can, especially where younger opera goers are concerned. So let me just ask you, if you were speaking with a teenager today, or even a 10, 12-year-old, whatever, are there any familiar characters from TV or from movies where you could say, that is a Rosina type or that is a Figaro type? Are there any connections of that kind that you can make?
I think Figaro is sometimes kind of like SpongeBob a little bit. Just a little, you know.
Nathan's the father of Fido.
Yeah, I like SpongeBob. I think SpongeBob is funny. Not terrible. I guess I had to watch it a few times. I had a relate. Maybe Figaro. What would he be like? He'd be a person who ran a website that sold cars and did matchmaking, and he had a, you know, Dear Figaro column, what should I do, sort of thing. You know? he would be that. Fashion, gossip, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That sort of thing.
Who would grow into Bill Gates type.
Do any Rosina types come to your mind?
I know who I think of that is like Rosina.
Who?
Elaine in Seinfeld.
Oh, I love that.
Really, a little bit, don't you think?
Yeah. Well, especially when I play it, because I'm always falling down. And,
yeah, that's true.
Know,
this is true.
I'm a bit of a klutz.
Nathan, thinking about Figaro, have you ever actually gone into a barber shop specifically to watch barbers work, see what they do? And if so, have you ever tried any of that in performance?
I've been in barber shops. I've, you know, had them shave me and all of that. I love that sort of thing. It takes way longer than I'm ever given the opportunity to do it. And I've used a straight edge to kind of figure out what, because we always have to do that. There was something, though. What was it that John Copley wanted? Oh, yeah, it's the thermometer bit. I've never used a mercury one, so I didn't know why I had to shake it. And so that was sort of new. At least not that I remember.
Well, he actually has a moment, though, where he does have to attempt to shave Bartolo.
Yeah, but the moment, this is the thing, though. And this part of the, like today, I stopped everything and came to a grinding halt because I forgot no notes. I just forgot to go, oh, ouch, basically. Because, you know, instead of when I was supposed to shave him, it was some sort of flavored whipped cream instead of shaving cream, so it kind of threw me off.
Cool whip,
yeah. And it was kind of stunk, and it was sticky, and I'm like, you know, and I'm saying, you know, to Phil, who's playing Bartolo, do you want me to put this on your face? And he's like, okay. And so by the time I got over there to wipe my hands off, everything had stopped, and they're all looking. I'm like, what? You know?
And the prompter's saying, ay, ay, ay.
Okay, then we can continue on. But so there's never really enough time, because when you get a shave, really, and some of you men may know this, you get to go in there and they put the hot towel on your face and you sit there for a while. Then they put you up, then they put the stuff on, then they wipe it off and you get the hot towel again. And it's great. I mean, it hurts like crazy, but it's great.
Now, before we get to questions from the audience, my final question. You know, Alma Viva has a last name and not a first name. Well, all we know about Figaro and Rosina is their first name. Have you ever fantasized if they had a last name, what it would actually be?
Rosina de Gracias. Well, I don't know. I just made that up. I've never fantasized about it, to actually to answer your question.
I think Figaro would either be one of those guys like Madonna who just has one name, Figaro, or it'd be like Figaro, Figaro.
Figaro, Figaro.
Because he does say that, doesn't he?
Hey, Figaro, Figaro. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, Figaro, Figaro. Or maybe his name is Figaro.
Well, for sure it's not Figaro.
Definitely not.
That's
an inside joke. That's why I didn't say that, thank you.
My husband's like totally now the color of his sweater.
Do we have any questions?
I hope you're blushing.
Do we have any questions from the floor? I hope we do. Right here. Speak loudly, please.
I've been really fortunate that most of those have been new productions, and that's a really, I'm spoiled because I've been able to create it with a director. My first major one was the director is a very strong woman, and her entire concept of The Barber of Seville was the liberation of women and the liberation of Rosina, and she started in a burqa. A full burqa, and it was set sort of in the Spanish, when the Moors take over in Spain. So everybody looked like, you know, it was a little testy because it was after 9/11, but they looked like Osama bin Laden.
The barber was out of work.
Yeah, totally. First entrance, all you could see was this. And slowly, clothes started coming off, and in the storm, she wrecks the entire room, and she strips off her clothes, and she's left in sort of a negligee. And literally, she has become, you know, woman. So it was very strong, and she was a really feisty Rosina. Another one with a woman director, we set it sort of in the 1950s, and Figaro was like Elvis character, and Rosina was sort of Doris Day. So it was very girly, and then this, and so it really depends on the concept. This is John envisioned this, that she's a lovely young woman, Spanish, so she's temperamental, and it's very much in the traditional mode, but it's that, and it also depends totally on the cast, completely on the interaction with the Figaro, with the Bartolo, and that can change my my dynamic a lot. If I forget to listen on stage, it's not fresh. If I can remember to listen, even if it's the same character a million times, it should still be fresh.
Right here. Yes.
Can you tell me what you do on the day of a performance?
I sleep in the morning of a show, unless it's a matinee, or an 11 o'clock staging orchestra rehearsal. But I'll sleep in. And in general, I try not to do anything so different. If I can try and be pretty regular on and eat a fairly decent balanced diet, I try and do the same. I try not to treat the performance day so different because that will make me nervous. If I go into a special routine, then, oh, there's something happening, I'll get nervous. But if I just make sure I'm rested and well-fed, I'll be okay.
I'm an early morning person. I'm not designed for the job I do. It's like, you know, if I could go to bed at 9:30 every night, it'd be great. But I can't, obviously, cause the show usually starts at 7:30 or 8. So I'll try to find a time for maybe a 15-minute nap. I want to be awake enough, though, before we start. So I'll take a 15-minute nap in the afternoon and have a good lunch and skip dinner. Also, I don't like to eat on a full stomach. For whatever reason. I don't know why. And then, you know.
Do you really sleep for 15 minutes?
Yeah. Why? I can't sleep longer than that or I get really groggy.
Winston Churchill did that.
Yeah, that's what I do.
Eleanor Roosevelt, too.
Power naps.
Yeah, power nap. I take a power nap. And other than that, I try not to do anything really too different either. I try not to fly anywhere. I hate flying somewhere.
I think the key is to maintain sort of a good level of health. And that's just kind of being aware of it every day. and that's challenging when you're moving around a lot.
Don't scream a lot the night before, whatever it might be. That's basically what I do.
Do we have any more questions?
I suppose it'll change a lot. I mean,
it'll probably change a lot. Like, if you see one performance with Phil Krause, who does the first three shows, it'll be one show. And when Andrew Shore comes in, I can pretty much guarantee it'll probably be a very different show. Bartolo is such an anchor in this piece, you know? He doesn't get much glory, I'm afraid, but he's a real anchor, and it's such a tough role.
I think he has the hardest aria, though.
He does.
I think his aria is definitely the hardest.
Murderous.
So it will vary. Luckily, we also have as an anchor the staging. It's very clear what needs to happen. There'll be little subtle changes in there, and the dynamic will change indefinitely. But
what's exciting about it is you come in, and there's a lot of recitative between Bartolo and Rosina. And if I'm not listening to his pacing and what he's doing, I'll be in trouble because I'll be doing it the way I did it with Phil. And so it makes, I don't know, for me, it makes it a very exciting thing because you don't really know what's going to happen next. So our first performance in particular, I think we have one run-through with him or something. Yeah. So it should be exciting, actually.
It's always fun, though. I did a lot of that in New York this fall because there was a different tenor every night for Romeo and Juliet. I was like, all right, let's see what this guy has to do.
Which one's the tenor?
That's right. The short one over in the corner with the blue tights.
It is going to be a glorious Barber Seville, in large part to these two singers. So I want to thank both of you, Nathan Gunn, Joyce DiDonato, very, very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features interviews with the creative forces behind the productions in the 2007-2008 season. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.